Welcome. Our topic for this program are new paradigms or new understandings about human beings and the universe in which we relate. And my guest today is Dr. Stanislaus Grof, a psychiatrist and author of numerous books, including Human Encounters, The Human Encounter with Death, Realms of the Human Unconscious, Beyond the Brain, LSD Psychotherapy, Beyond Death, and other books and numerous articles as well. Welcome, Stan. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
In your work with LSD psychotherapy and exploring the very depths of the human unconscious, you've made some very strong statements, Stan, and one of them seems to be that as we look deeply at the human mind, what we encounter are phenomena and perspectives that are simply beyond traditional ways of thinking of things. In other words, that we need to have a new understanding of ourselves and the world in which we relate.
Yes, I would just expand it a little.
All right.
That just the initial 2 decades of my work involved clinical work with psychedelics. The last 10 years, my wife Christina and I have been working with non-drug techniques, which involves breathing, controlled breathing, sound, music, certain kind of body work, and we essentially see the whole spectrum, the same spectrum of experiences that we used to see in psychedelic work, and also challenging observations of the same kind. So we are not discussing challenges just from the LSD experience.
It would be a mistake then to say that all of these experiences reported under LSD are due to the effects of the drug alone.
That's right. The best way you can understand the effects of LSD is to say that it's a nonspecific catalyst, mm-hmm. or it's an amplifier, so that when you take LSD, you are actually taking a journey into your own psyche. You don't mm-hmm. have an LSD experience.
Yeah.
So it's an experience mediated by the pharmacological effect.
One of the ways in which I understood LSD, to digress a little bit about it, is that what it seems to do is act as a replacement or a blocker for the neurohormone serotonin, which is a neural inhibitor. So it's inhibiting an inhibitor and allowing more neurons to fire. In other words, letting the brain do more of what it naturally does anyway.
Yes, that's one of the major hypotheses about, you know, there's no unanimity about that.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting that something like increased rate of breathing can also induce very similar kinds of experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if it happens without the intervention of a rather exotic drug, if it happens with something as physiological as breathing, it's very clear that we are discussing certain dynamics of the human psyche, mm-hmm. that we are not discussing some kind of toxic state.
Let me go back a little bit and try and create a historical perspective. You began your research as a psychiatrist in doing LSD research, but you came from a Freudian perspective originally.
Yes, my primary interest was mm-hmm. in psychotherapy, in Freudian mm-hmm. psychotherapy. I had theoretical training. I had also mm-hmm. personal training analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really my disappointment was the efficacy of Freudian analysis mm-hmm. that brought me to
people
the LSD work.
Generally say of Freud today that his insights into the human mind were very penetrating, but that psychoanalytic therapy is considered somewhat laughable in terms of getting the kind of results that other therapies are known to achieve today.
I think that Freud's contributions, you know, as a single mm-hmm. individual were just amazing,
yes.
but of course these were the first mm-hmm. steps. And I think that his followers and his disciples are really lagging mm-hmm. behind the potential that uh-huh. Freud had.
Well, Freud initiated a revolution into our understanding of the human mind when he talked about subconscious and unconscious influences on behavior. And at the same time that Freud was making these remarkable discoveries, many other things were happening in our culture. In physics, for example, there was a major shift from classical Newtonian physics to a view of what goes on inside of the atom.
Mm-hmm.
And things like the uncertainty principle were being discovered at the same time as Freud's discoveries. And artwork in our culture began to change. It's as if one might almost think that artists like Picasso in the early 20th century artists were telepathically expressing what Freud was trying to say, looking mm-hmm. at the unconscious, looking underneath things somehow.
Well, there were also simultaneously some other very powerful things happening.
Mm-hmm.
For example, many very prominent, very brilliant disciples of Freud's were bringing their own insights, their own theories, yeah. challenging somehow the thinking of mm-hmm. Freud. And sooner or later they left the psychoanalytic movement, or they mm-hmm. were expelled from it, and they became renegades. They created their own schools.
People like Wilhelm Reich or Carl Jung.
And particularly Carl Gustav Jung. Mm-hmm. And it's actually the work of these, or Otto Rank, for example,
the trauma of birth. Mm-hmm.
It's actually the work of these renegades that is now being confirmed by mm-hmm. modern consciousness research. And it also is their work that seems mm-hmm. to be converging with some of these advances uh-huh. in modern physics and in information theory and some other areas.
And you yourself and your work seem to be unique in the sense that you are synthesizing these divergent schools not only within psychiatry but also trying to integrate them with these other leading edge aspects in our culture going on in biology and physics today.
So I think what happened, you see, when we introduced first the chemical catalyst, mm-hmm. LSD or some other psychedelics, and then particularly the breathing, the element that sort of activates the psyche and induces spontaneous kinds of powerful experiences, was that the experiences did not limit themselves to biography mm-hmm. and to the individual unconscious, which according to Freud is all there is in the human psyche, and that people were having a whole range of experiences. Mm-hmm. And some of them seem to be very much Rankian, they're involved,
the
reliving of the birth trauma. Others, they're very Reichian, they involve powerful bioenergies, dramatic kind of experiences, physical expressions of the process. But
we should just mention for our viewers that what Reich was talking about is that our character is sort of in our muscular armor, he used the term. Our personality is kind of locked into our muscles.
Yes, and also problems that we might have, emotional mm-hmm. or psychosomatic, are not just somehow anchored in the mind, but they have real expression and manifestation in what he called the muscular mm-hmm. armor.
And the energies of the body itself.
Yes, and then what probably came as a major surprise in this kind of work was confirmation of some the major contributions of Carl Gustav Jung, mm-hmm. that we don't have just individual unconscious, the way Freud was talking about it, but also collective unconscious, that in these unusual states we can tune in some sense into the heritage of all of humanity. We can experience, for example, elements of other cultures, racial, mm-hmm. collective mm-hmm. unconscious. We can tune into mythological, or what Jung called archetypal, dynamics. We can experience mythology of other cultures mm-hmm. that we, prior to this experience, had absolutely no intellectual knowledge of.
One of the major insights that Jung made that you seem to have confirmed in your work, Stan, is the concept of the synchronicity, that somehow when we are working at the deep and powerful level of the human mind, the archetypal level, that events in the external world come together by no known mechanistic manner to confirm these insights or to complement or enhance them.
Yes, that's one of the important aspects of it, you know, but uh-huh. I would say the more broader new insight here
yes.
has to do with the nature of consciousness and the relationship between consciousness and matter and somehow the role of consciousness in the universe. And I think synchronicity is just a very manifest expression of that. The synchronistic events are events in which something that is our intrapsychic happening, like mm-hmm. a dream or a vision, suddenly seems to enter into a kind of playful interaction yeah. with elements of the physical reality.
It would almost lead one to conclude that the universe itself is emergence from the mind.
Yeah, so that, you know, consciousness is somehow woven into the fabric of the universe.
Yeah.
Consciousness is not something that emerges as an accident after billions of years of evolution, something that requires a central nervous system.
Mm-hmm. Not simply an epiphenomenon, as the materialists
that's right.
would say.
Of course, not human consciousness, but it's something that we can call cosmic consciousness or cosmic creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And the synchronicities are very, very fascinating phenomena that seem to suggest that there is a very different kind of mm-hmm. relationship between consciousness and matter mm-hmm. than the one that's suggested by mechanistic traditional mm-hmm. science, you see, where there is a physical, objectively existing world, and somehow within that consciousness develops in the central nervous system and is just simply reflecting the objective world out there.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you've reported in your work with these mm-hmm. deep forms of therapy is what we might call past life regression, that people seem to relive previous lifetimes. Can you comment on
yes.
that?
Well, that's one of the very important experiences, one from a whole category that we now call transpersonal experiences. Mm-hmm. And really every single phenomenon out of this category represents a fundamental challenge to our ordinary understanding of who we are and how consciousness is related to matter. But in this particular category, in the past life experiences, the person who is in a non-ordinary state of consciousness suddenly experiences some kind of very powerful sequence that seems to be happening in another culture, in another century. They would have some very, very involved role in this. For example, some of them can involve the situations of being wounded, being threatened in some kind of fundamental way, or mm-hmm. strong emotions such as hatred or jealousy. As they are having these experiences, they would suddenly get access to new information about the culture or the historical period which they are experiencing. For example, related to architecture, costumes, weapons, social structure of a particular
things
situation.
Things that they were not likely to have known?
Yes, that they mm-hmm. quite definitely did not know. Mm-hmm. And in some instances, even historical events. And what is also very important about the past life experience as a critical characteristic is that they have a sense of a personal memory. Mm-hmm. It's not just I'm witnessing something or I'm identifying with a person from another time, from another culture, but I actually once was that person. In other words, what I'm now experiencing, this is not the first time it's happening to me. Yeah. I have already been through it. It happened to the same unit of consciousness. Mm-hmm. The only way I can describe this is compare it to the sense of memory that we have in everyday life, mm-hmm. the basis of which we distinguish between, let's say, fantasies, daydreams, and real memories. If I ask you, what did you do last weekend? And you say, I went sailing on the bay. And I would now say, well, how do you know it really happened? Maybe you're just imagining it. You see, there's something within your psyche that's telling you that this particular content is supposed to be treated as a memory of a real event. Mm-hmm. And so the same kind of sense accompanies these past life experiences. Mm-hmm. There's another important aspect that is interesting for me as a therapist, and that is that they are eminently healing. I have seen situations where people had serious emotional problems, phobias, depression, asthma, and so on. And they would trace it back to this kind of past life situation. And then when they allow themselves to have a full experience of that mm-hmm. reincarnation scene, then suddenly symptoms that had resisted, in some instances, years of traditional psychoanalysis disappear.
Would you say that the past life recollections have more healing potential than some of the other transpersonal experiences, such as encounters with deities and the like, that you would deal
with? I think every type of transpersonal uh-huh. experience has really a healing potential. Mm-hmm. And that is very important because even therapists who, you know, don't believe in the transpersonal should really be open enough to work with these experiences, because otherwise they are limiting somehow the range of the healing mechanisms. Mm-hmm. And they would not be as effective as they could be mm-hmm. with certain kinds of clinical problems.
And in arriving at a new vision of the human being and the environment, one of the things that I suppose we really need to do is look at the mechanisms or the drama, perhaps, behind these healing phenomena. mechanisms may in itself be a trap. Mm-hmm. A trap
yes.
word there.
Yes.
But
yes. There's, if I can go back for a yes. for a moment, you see, I would like to just make this very clear that I do not see these aspects of past life experiences as a proof of reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
That these are not necessarily a proof that we have lived before and there's a continuity of soul.
It would be very difficult to prove that logically, regardless of the evidence.
No, just the fact that our psyche, when stimulated, creates these mm-hmm. powerful experiences, that somehow there's access to new information mm-hmm. about time and place
yes.
where they're happening, that they have tremendous propensity for healing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something else that they frequently associated with synchronicities.
Yes.
For example, the person has the feeling that in the context of a past life experience, he resolved a relationship with another person who is actually currently present in their life.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly they find out that synchronistically, just at the time when they resolved that issue on the past life level, something happened in the life of that other person, so that when they meet next time, suddenly their relationship is clear.
They may have been hundreds or thousands
yes.
of miles apart, and yet there was that connection.
Yes. So that's still, those are not in the category of proof that we have lived before. But you can see that uh-huh. something like literal belief in karma that the Hindus have, for example, or the Buddhists and so on, that's a very plausible hypothesis covering the range of phenomena that I just described.
It's pointing us in the direction that we might want to look at for new interpretations of the way humans interact with their environment, I suppose.
Yes.
We're probably too sophisticated, at least in Western culture, to accept an ancient Oriental view as is, but with new developments that are happening now in physics and in biology and new theoretical approaches in system science, these ancient ideas may well be workable for us or
yes,
can be
also
integrated.
You see, there are also situations that come a little closer to something that we would consider proof.
Uh-huh.
Maybe one out of 100 of these past life experiences bring some very unusual details.
Oh, yes.
And the circumstances are such mm-hmm. that actually you can go to archives or libraries and do some systematic research. And we have a few case histories where something very remarkable happened. You mm-hmm. see, it's a very unusual type of experience that brought specific, very esoteric type of information that then could be verified mm-hmm. by independent research.
Let me go back to a personal experience that I know that you had. Many years ago when I met you, you showed me drawings that you had created, I believe, when you were still living in Czechoslovakia, that seemed like early Mesoamerican Indian drawings. They just came
yes.
to you spontaneously, didn't they?
Yes, but this is very common, that somehow in these states you see people connect with elements of what Jung would call collective unconscious. You suddenly get access to mythological themes. You can have an
motifs
experience.
Motifs of other cultures.
Suddenly you experience uh-huh. the Sumerian underworld. You have images of those deities. You understand their functions. You can draw them.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you go to the corresponding book of Sumerian mythology, you find out that those were accurate insights.
This
is something that Jung based his concept of the collective unconscious on.
Yeah. Where do you think this leads us in terms of understanding ourselves?
Well, these experiences suggest, you see, that each of us can, under certain circumstances, in a non-ordinary state of consciousness, experience anything that is part of existence.
Mm-hmm.
That somehow our consciousness can expand to encompass any aspect of space-time, anything that was, is, and possibly will be. And that it can also move into these archetypal mythological realms and can accurately mm-hmm. experience elements of any mythology of the world.
That's a very powerful statement that you just yes. made.
Well, what it suggests is that our identity in this sense, you see, is not limited to the body ego, what Alan Watts used to call skin encapsulated ego, but that somehow, at least experientially, our identity stretches from the body ego to the totality of existence
mm-hmm.
and also anything in between.
We and are all that is, was, or ever will be.
That's right.
That's a very powerful
at least,
statement
yes.
to me.
Yes, and there are, uh-huh. you see, there are again developments, as you mentioned, in modern science
mm-hmm.
that gives us some scientific models or at least conceptual aids to understand how something like this is possible. And what I have in mind is particularly the so-called holographic or holonomic model. You know, some of the principles that you can study in optical holography involve similar kinds of elements, like a distributed information. Yeah. You can cut up a hologram in many pieces, and each of them will still reflect the whole image.
Only you lose some detail. It becomes vaguer.
That's right.
More amorphous. So in a sense, maybe we ourselves are holograms of the universe.
Yes, or reality somehow itself is created with the use of similar principles that operate in holography.
Well, there is a notion in physics, I think an important one, that the distinction between subjective and objective reality is no longer quite considered as pure or as valid as it used to be.
Well, that's one aspect of it. And the other aspect that's coming from modern physics, of course, is that true objects really don't exist. I mean, separation between objects, that somehow in subatomic analysis, the world breaks down into a unified web of relations. So there are no clear boundaries. Any kind of boundaries
Everything
are
is
arbitrary.
Interconnected.
And that's an interesting parallel with the transpersonal experience, where we find out that what we perceive as mandatory boundaries in everyday life don't apply in those states, and that we can expand our identity to anything in the universe.
Do you see implications for this understanding in terms of solving social problems or dealing with ethical issues?
Yes, there's a very important development within transpersonal psychology, because I believe that the traditional, what has been referred to as Cartesian-Newtonian paradigm that treats the world as the world of material objects and human beings as just highly developed animals, biological machines, you see, in a sense justifies the Darwinian law of the survival of the fittest, the idea that we are perfectly entitled and that it is possible to get a better deal than somebody else.
Do unto others before they do unto you.
Yes, or that one nation can get a better deal than the others.
Yeah.
And this kind of understanding shows this as a very short-sighted and these days also unscientific
predicated upon the notion of closed systems and
yes,
separateness.
We cannot somehow function separately from the system in which we are embedded. So we cannot do things to nature that we don't do to ourselves, for example. We cannot do things to other nations that wouldn't boomerang. And so it develops kind of transpersonal ethics. It also develops a new kind of transpersonal approach to politics, when the idea is the world has a problem, you see, and the only possibility of solution would be, what do we do about it?
Yes. Well, can you then apply the psychiatric insights that you've developed, the ethical and political insights, say from the point of view of what might be called community psychology or community psychiatry, what can we do? How can we?
Well, the most important thing here, of course, would be to introduce somehow technologies that can mediate these transpersonal types of insights so that people would complement their functioning in everyday life with some kind of focused introspection, self-discovery, let's say regular meditation or involvement in one of the many humanistic transpersonal forms of self-exploration. So that we would sort of complement, you know, our technological understanding with the deep wisdom or the deep insight that is coming from the transpersonal, from the collective sources. We would sort of combine those two.
Doesn't it occur to people, though, and certainly in your work, as people begin to do this exploration, often what they encounter are the demonic, the dark forces, the destructive urges. In fact, this is why I think many groups of people are sort of afraid of the subconscious.
Well, I think what you discover, you see, is that on all the levels, the human psyche, the human personality has two polar opposite. It's it's a yin-yang. It has a light and it has a dark force. It has a good and an evil force. And what I'm talking about is to create socially sanctioned, almost ritual type of situations in which we could confront these forces and and integrate them and sort of purge them out of our system, the way cultures do in rites of passage, for example, on other kinds of death, rebirth mysteries or some other ritual frameworks. Many people who have done this kind of work came to the conclusion they would rather confront these dark forces in their process than watch them on the evening TV news, you see, because otherwise if we don't confront them realistically, they will tend to leak into our everyday life and have a very powerful self-destructive and destructive impact on collective life.
You know, Jung wrote a book, Modern Man in Search of a Soul, in which it seemed to him that is in our modern culture with its enormous technology, we're somehow losing touch with this level of the depths within us. And I should think since he wrote that book 50 years ago, things have gotten worse in that direction.
You see, also in the Jungian psychology, sort of colloquially said, what you are repressing is ultimately going to get you. I mean, it's going to, the repressed is going to emerge and find its way somehow to manifestation. So if we are not realistic and do not confront these forces in an appropriate sort of supportive framework, then we will be forced to confront them in ways that will be much more destructive.
In other words, we have to recognize it within ourselves. We have to deal with it within ourselves because it will come back to us anyhow.
Yes, well, if you look, for example, at a situation in Germany, one of the most advanced cultures in the world, you see, that really repressed these certain elements, then was led into a catastrophe when these forces started erupting and they became a kind of social reality.
And we certainly have to keep remembering these lessons from the past. Well, Stan, it's been a pleasure having you with me today. We've been able to, in a way, come whole circle and look at the ways in which ethics and politics and psychology, psychiatry and physics and biology somehow all are part of the same fabric, all part of the interconnectedness that's within us. Thank you very much for being here.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And thank you very much for being with us also.
This has been Thinking Aloud, a production of Spectrum Foundation. For information about the series or about the more than 100 titles in the Thinking Aloud video collection, please write to Thinking Aloud, 315 3rd Street, Suite 161, San Rafael, California, 94901, or phone 415-456-2532.